Hi, I'm just practicing just to get an idea of like how loud I have to speak and like this?
Yeah.
All right, how's that?
Yeah, very good.
Okay, I'm gonna start feeling like I'm shouting. So if my level starts going like this, start going like this, so I can bring it back up. Is this okay, or did I go down?
That's okay.
Up.
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Adrienne Cardwell. I've been working with Other Minds for about 3 years now. Two out of those 3 years, I have been focused on managing our archive and directing our preservation project, which is why we are here today.
Here.
Cannot hear?
Talk to the people in the last row. Everybody else will
wait. Hi. Okay, maybe I should come. How's this? Oh, I can't do my...
I can click through for you if you need me to.
What's that?
If you're using a PowerPoint, I can click if you want to move forward.
It's okay. Okay. I've got to make myself do this, so. I'll talk loud. Good? Okay. In case you missed it, my name's Adrienne. I'm working for Other Minds, a nonprofit organization in San Francisco dedicated to, getting louder. Okay, I'm sorry. Let's move on. So as I was saying, I've been working for 3 years with Other Minds. Two out of those 3 years, I've been managing our archive and our preservation project, which is what we're here to talk about. So real quick, I would just want to let you know what our organization is all about. I think we're mostly known for the Other Minds Festival of New Music, which happens yearly. We're in our 13th season, and our last festival took place just this month. It spans usually 3 days, but before the concerts, there is a residency program for the composers and performers involved, and that takes place at Jurassic Ranch, which isn't too far from here. It's in Woodside, and it's very beautiful. About 2 years ago, in 2005, we started hosting the New Music Seance, which takes place in San Francisco's Swedenborgian Church. It's a very intimate and a little bit eerie, but it's like a marathon of piano music and piano and violin music. And this year, it's going to happen in December, so I think it'll be the perfect weather for that kind of setting. Other Minds Records, we have about 13 releases now, and I don't know if you've seen our table out in the exhibition hall, but we have a CD catalog that's free that you can take, and all of our releases are on the table. Weekly Music from Other Minds, that's our radio presence on San Francisco's KALW. It airs every Friday night at 11 p.m. It's hosted by Richard Friedman, who is the president of Other Minds, one of our board members. And lastly, our preservation and access project that is keeping us pretty busy for the last 5 to 8 years, and it's become a huge part of our organization now. And so we're really happy to share what we've been doing with all of you here today. And I want to introduce our executive and artistic director, Charles Armorkanyan. He's gonna give us a little background on the station KPFA, also how we came to acquiring about 4,000 items from their music department archive. Charles was also music director at KPFA from 1969 to 1992, and he is co-founder of Other Minds.
Thanks, Adrienne. KPFA Radio, for those of you who don't know, went on the air in 1949 on April 15th. Just at the advent of FM radio. It was founded by journalist and poet Lewis Hill and fellow conscientious objectors who had been in work camps during World War II. When they were released, they immediately set about starting a radio station, quote, not only to disseminate the diversity of thought and art produced by this and other societies, but to make possible a way of life for individuals of artistic and intellectual abilities to contribute to the culture themselves. Among their basic principles was to maintain an independent funding base, free of commercial sponsors and editorial pressures. To this day, there have been no commercials on the 5 Pacifica radio stations, which are in Berkeley, New York, Los Angeles, Houston, and in Washington, D.C. Being free from commercial pressures, it became the first radio station to hold frank discussions about the use of marijuana, about Marxism, homosexuality, the first to broadcast the poetry of Allen Ginsberg. And to do this, KPFA invented the wonderful on-air fundraising drive, which we all know and love. In the area of music programming, KPFA made an international reputation. In the very first months of its broadcasting, composer Leonard Rosenman, whom you might know as the composer of film scores, introduced a program called Meet the Composer, which premiered with a live interview and a concert of music by Roger Sessions, who then was teaching composition at UC Berkeley. By the way, you can go on our website and hear a 1953 recording of him with the Griller String Quartet, the people who recorded this wonderful album of Ernst Bloch's music. Bloch was at the conservatory in San Francisco at the time. But in this program from 1953, the Griller Quartet rehearsed Sessions' second string quartet ad nauseum for 2 hours, inhaling on their pipes and commenting to each other with their English accents, and it's absolutely hilarious. Other guests in just the first year included Henry Cowell playing his tone clusters on the piano, Harry Partch, Darius Milhaud, Ernst Krenek, and Ernst Bloch himself. KPFA's music directors, who always were composers or critics in the classical music field, included Robert Erickson, who founded the music department at UC San Diego much later, Alan Rich, later the music critic of Newsweek and the LA Herald Tribune, and the composers Glenn Glasow, Charles Scheer, Howard Hirsch, and Will Ogden. It's notable that for the population size that the Bay Area has, there's an intense amount of new music activity here to this day, and I attribute it to the presence of KPFA, because people grew up here learning about contemporary and avant-garde music from an early date. We're going to play you an excerpt from a 1963 interview with radical composer John Cage. The interviewer, actually this was done on WNYC in New York, is Jonathan Cott, who later became known as a writer for Rolling Stone magazine, but then he was a young, rather straight-laced academic. He grills his guest on the recent premiere of Cage's Concert for Piano and Orchestra.
To be quite blunt, as you have allowed the pianist in your piano concerto to choose at random musical phrases and sounds, and thus forfeiting your control over the development of an imaginative musical idea, how can we qualitatively even begin to compare your concerto with, say, Schoenberg's magnificent work in the same genre? I wonder if that's a fair question.
Yes, you want to know whether you can compare these two things, and...
Qualitatively, yes.
Well, those are two things I'm not particularly interested in. That is to say, I'm not particularly interested in quality, and I'm certainly not interested in comparisons between things. I think that we gain in awareness by seeing each thing in its own terms. And I think that if we think in terms of quality, that means that we are comparing the work which we experience with standards which represent our prejudices.
I'd like to thank Andy Lancet. Are you here, Andy? He's with WNYC in New York, and he confirmed that this was the only known recording of this particular interview. It was sent to KPFA by somebody in New York because we were interested in Cage, and fortunately the tape was kept because it's a very interesting snapshot on John Cage's use of his sort of Buddhist outlook to parry these thrusts from the young Jonathan Cott. So these sorts of things turn up repeatedly in the KPFA archive, not just things produced at KPFA, but things that were sent to us and squirreled away by our catalogers. KPFA was a hotbed of interest in the emerging field of electronic music. Here is Pauline Oliveros working the controls of an early synthesizer in the studios of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. The center had a broadcast booth just to the side of the performance area where KPFA would broadcast live concerts from there on 321 Divisadero Street to all of Northern California. I grew up in Fresno, and I would go to somebody's house who had a big antenna, and we would listen to these concerts live. It was pretty thrilling. Sometimes there were theater pieces and there was nothing audible going on, and the announcer would, if it sounded like a bowling match, the person would describe what was going on to the audience. KPFA was also the first to broadcast interviews and music of composer Conlon Nancarrow, who is now acknowledged as one of the great geniuses of 20th century music. He created piano music by punching holes in virgin player piano rolls to make pieces that are humanly impossible to play, and we'll play you an excerpt of his study number 25. That recording was made by Robert Shoemaker, who is one of the people who's digitizing the tapes for us. Bob, would you raise your hand? He recorded all of Nan Caro's music for 1750 Arch Records and later for Verigo in Germany. And we're about to bring out the four LP set that used to be on the 1750 Arch label on the Other Minds record label in 2 months. This is just one of the many little-known composers that became a specialty of KPFA. On our website, radiohome.org, you can hear in-depth documentaries on George Antheil, Edgar Varèse, Dane Rudyard, Leo Ornstein, Ivan Vishnogradsky, and Henry Brandt, as well as numerous programs featuring women composers, which was a particular specialty of KPFA. We also broadcast numerous interviews and performances of the evolving field of sound poetry. Here on the left is Bernard Heitzig on the streets of Paris. And that's me with the beard. And then on the right, we're broadcasting from the Cabrillo Music Festival. I'm recording commentary live during a concert that's being conducted by Dennis Russell Davies, who was then the music director of that festival in Santa Cruz. Starting in 1970, everybody had cassette machines that were portable. We initiated something called the World Ear Project, which pioneered the broadcasting of ambient sound recordings unaltered and for long periods of time. These recordings were sent from all over the world and became a fascinating month-long feature on the station. But most amazing of all was the series Radio Events. In these projects, we would have a particular artist in mind. We would give them as much airtime as they wanted, and we'd say, whatever you do, you have to involve the audience physically. And so Anna Halperin, the choreographer, played music and asked people to rearrange their furniture in time with the music, and she gradually ramped up the speed of the music. And people then called in and described what had happened. And with the very soothing music of an orchestral piece by Debussy, we put the phone interviews on, and one person had broken his coffee table. This is another event. It was in Berkeley. The Oakland conceptual artist Paul Cotton urged listeners to come down to Ho Chi Minh Park, where he was costumed as a bunny all in white. What they didn't know when the mob appeared was that Paul Cotton also had a hole in his costume so that he had his private parts exposed. They were painted white like a Buto dancer, but it was pretty startling. And the police arrived shortly thereafter, but they didn't stop the program because nobody seemed to take offense. But you can see that that's what people are looking at here. It's a little difficult to translate on the radio, but we did our best. All this marvelous material normally in the United States would have been discarded, erased. Nobody cared about this kind of material. Most of the radio stations that did interviews of this type did not save their recordings. So I was called after my resignation as music director many years later when I was running Other Minds by the general manager of KPFA, who was panicking because the Pacifica Foundation directors were deciding to throw out all the people at the radio station in Berkeley. They had even plans to sell the building, which was then still only about 8 years old, brand new, beautiful radio building in Berkeley. They were going to sell the archives or get rid of everything on site and sell the frequency, which was 94.1 FM. Now that frequency is not on the far left of the dial, it's in the commercial spectrum. And of course that had more value than you can imagine, and they thought they could save the foundation by making the sale. So he urged me to come down to the station, save the tapes by taking them and preserving them, knowing the value of the interviews and the concerts they contained. I spoke with the Hewlett Foundation, and they gave us a few thousand dollars to move the tapes physically to Attow Fine Arts Storage in Oakland, which is run by a man who saves all the great works of art for people who are collectors here. He has a large facility, and he was also a fanatic KPFA listener. His name is Scott Attow. And so through his good graces and free, for the last 8 years, he's housed the tapes while we're digitizing them. As I participated in many of these programs, I'm in touch with most of the composers still, and they're 100% ecstatic that these things are available online and are available globally. And from a personal point of view, I get funny messages from Adrian and from Stephen Upjohn, our cataloger, who are listening to these tapes and coming into me and saying, do you remember what you did in 1974 with so-and-so? And I haven't the slightest memory of any of it.
Hi, I'm Stephen Upjohn. I'm the cataloger for Other Minds. I have been trained as a librarian, so when I took on the task to catalog this archive, my initial thought was, what if this collection had gone directly to a library? How would they handle the situation? It seems to me that in that case, such an archive would have been fairly quickly cataloged by a staff of librarians and assistants, librarians who on the whole probably would have had limited knowledge of avant-garde music, even in an academic music library where most librarians have advanced degrees in music, it is unlikely that they would have had a whole lot of expertise in the type of radical avant-garde classical jazz or experimental rock music that characterizes this archive. Anyways, these librarians would no doubt catalog the collection according to strict MARC standards and perhaps upload the catalog records to WorldCat or a similar collective online catalog. In order to access the actual recordings, one would have to go to the library or perhaps be able to obtain them through some sort of interlibrary loan. As a result, the collection would be largely restricted to limited community of users, the majority of which might be academic researchers, and there would probably be no immediate plans to provide open, public, online access to the collection. Given that possibility, it is indeed fortunate that the unique collection did not end up going directly to a library, but instead was saved from obscurity by a small local 501c3, or nonprofit organization. A most fortuitous event, because as a nonprofit, Other Minds was in many ways uniquely qualified to preserve and provide public access to this archive. Other Minds is an organization that is devoted to promoting new music. It is led by an individual whose entire professional life has been committed to exposing the public to the work of experimental and avant-garde composers, musicians, artists, and poets, who even more importantly was actually involved with the original recordings and radio broadcasts that formed the backbone of the archive. In addition, the staff of Other Minds have a personal relationship with many of the composers and performers on the recordings. They are well informed about avant-garde music and can easily assist me with the many questions that come up when cataloging the collection. As a relatively well-known and respected nonprofit organization, already dependent on gifts and grants for its normal operations, Other Minds was well situated to obtain the dedicated funding for its digitization project. Other Minds is also dedicated to using the internet to provide open access to its archives as a primary objective. As a result, much of the collection has been made freely and conveniently available to anyone in the world with an internet connection and has not been restricted to largely academic audiences. Anybody interested in an obscure composer's work just needs to enter that name into a search engine like Google, and within a couple of clicks can quickly listen to rarely heard performances, interviews, and documentaries. However, cataloging this archive for Other Minds did present a number of difficult challenges. As a small nonprofit, Other Minds could not afford integrated library software that would have made strict MARC cataloging possible. It also does not have the resources to provide adequate storage for its archive of digital content. The reels themselves had no printed labels, there was little in the way of additional textual information about the recordings, and what information there was, either written on the tape box or on the KPF or in the KPFA program guides, it was at times misleading or incorrect. In addition, because we are using a FileMaker Pro database that is then exported as a flat XML file and displayed on the website using MySQL programming, the end user interface is not as robust as a normal library catalog, which is based on a true relational database. Other challenges included figuring out how best to make a small yet varied collection appear cohesive with lots of meaningful cross-indexing. And because the content was so international in scope, but had to be cataloged based on its auditory content only, being able to decipher foreign-sounding names and titles is a major issue, especially when spoken by individuals with heavy foreign accents. For example, listen to these three clips and see if you can figure out what they're saying.
And it's played by Heite van der Schaaf. Difficult to pronounce for you, Heite van der Schaaf, but for our Dutch people it's rather easy.
Is that a man?
Good to know.
Our director of this is was Tatul Artomian. This song we play is Ichab Marmand Irikun Yev Kan Tsakats Sari Kanashlanjin.
Okay. For those of you who got the spelling of the first two names correctly and can meet me after this talk to give me that last title, I'd be very impressed and grateful. However, despite the difficulties, progress has been made. We managed to partner with an inexpensive web designer who helped implement our website and wrote the MySQL code. The Internet Archive has been essential in providing us with storage space. When there is no textual information, the only solution is to listen closely and often and conduct a lot of research, mostly using the web and such resources as the Grove Dictionary of Music, but also by talking to the staff. While our website is not a true relational database, we did come up with creative programming to make it look and feel as if it were. All our name and subject headings link to other relevant programs, but rather than having them work by simply resorting a database the way a library catalog would, they operate by conducting a search for an exact match for a controlled vocabulary term that then produces a list of resulting programmers the user can browse. To increase cross-indexing functionality, I decided to use abbreviated or more general subject headings. So when you click on one, it takes you to similar programs or pieces of music, even if they would not share the exact same Library of Congress subject heading. So while we do use Library of Congress authorized names and subject headings, thus making the collection suitable for delivery to an academic institution, there is a little bit of wiggle room with some of those headings. So here's a sample record from our database, and you can see that it has many fields that will closely map to MARC or Dublin Core. And this is just the metadata for the descriptive cataloging. There's additional fields for tracking and technical information and other project management sources. And here's a screenshot of the web page that correlates the same record. As you can see, the information has been pulled directly from the database and displayed in what we hope is an attractive and informative manner. Much thought had to be given how to format the metadata in the database so that it would also appear nicely on the website. For instance, and this may dismay any other librarians out there, I chose to capitalize most words in the title of a musical selection, despite this being against current cataloging rules, but I thought an attractive display was more important than strict adherence to library rules. Yet perhaps the biggest challenge this archive presents to the cataloger is its incredible variety of frankly rather strange, often quite funny, but also fairly unclassifiable material. Perhaps you heard the audio clip at the start of our presentation. That was Jim Nolman performing a sort of call and response with a flock of 300 tom turkeys. For another piece, Nolman crawled into a warren of kangaroo rats in Death Valley and formed a sort of percussion ensemble with their stamping feet. Just try to find a Library of Congress subject heading to cover that. Other memorable recordings include a master didgeridoo player jamming with the sounds of a dozen or so foghorns that were piped in from the Bay Area and subject to various delay effects. A 1967 press conference with William S. Burroughs, in which he waxes rhapsodically on political conspiracy theories and the possibility of alien mind control experiments, all in that distinctive gravelly voice, leaving the awestruck press corps noticeably wondering whether they dare ask another question. We have Frank Zappa talking to a young reporter, taking on a young reporter's inane questions, and while not being exactly cruel, he does respond in that characteristically sarcastic yet very humorous way that anybody who's heard Zappa knows that he was capable of. We have a number of very entertaining lectures by Nicholas Slonimsky, a composer and author who's probably unknown to most of you, but who at the age of 90 could still keep an audience in absolute stitches with his funny stories and ingenious piano playing. Soprano scat singing with weird electronic sounds, modern poetry readings, ambient recordings of frogs, trains, thunderstorms, and street life from around the world, late night in-studio shenanigans and prank calls by young Berkeley hipsters, as well as many remarkably beautiful and pristine recordings of exceptional contemporary classical and new music performed by the world's best musicians. To give you just tiny sense of the sort of gems that this is in the archive, I'll play you a few clips. This is Henry Cow strumming on the insides of a piano. The next is from an early concert by the 1960s radical avant-garde electronic group, Musica Electronica Viva. Archive has a number of works of sound poetry and music concrete, such as this work from Susan Stone.
If you are inexperienced, hold the cleaver in both hands.
Carefully. Insert. Insert here. Handle lightly.
Very lightly.
Then use.
Don't bang your fingers.
From a concert organized by Charles that reintroduced the music of George Antheil. From the World Ear Project, here's a field recording of the backyard of Lou Harrison. There is quite a bit of jazz, including this work from the Dutch group ICP Tentet. Many works by international composers, including this from Karl Heinz Stockhausen. And if you find it a little overwhelming, you are not alone, as this call from KPFA listener will
attest. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hi, I find that I'm having trouble getting started with anything. I'm 19 and I'm just, you know, still absorbing, but I think I want to retire because I don't have anything that makes electric noises. So sometimes my toaster, when the toast doesn't come up, it makes a great noise, but that's about all I can think of. So I don't know, I think I'm retiring early.
And with that, I'll turn it over to Adrian, who will discuss the digitization project.
Thanks, Stephen. Actually, Stephen picked out quite a number of clips that happened to be some of my, I won't say personal favorites because I have a lot, but if we have a couple minutes left at the end, I do have a little collage that I made of some of my personal favorites, so hopefully we can get to that if I can run through all the serious stuff right now quickly but effectively. And I'm going to try and stand up here because I feel like maybe I can be heard better than if I stand behind the podium, even though the podium only goes up to my chest, but I still feel like it's impeding on my... So where are we? Okay, just some quick statistics here. The Other Minds Archive obviously started with the programming that Other Minds has done, video, audio, photographs, etc. In recent years, we also acquired material from the estate of the composer George Antheil. But obviously, for the sake of this presentation, we're focusing on the KPFA Music Department tapes, which is slightly over 4,000 items, ranging from the dates 1953 to 1995. Approximately 3,500 hours of material, 80% which we've designated as being rare and unique, and it's that 80% that we are aiming to digitize. Most of them, it's quarter inch tape, mostly on 10 and 7 inch reels. We do also have little baby 5 inch reels, and sometimes we do have 1 inch tape, 2 inch tape. The dats were pretty much, we're almost through all the dats. There aren't a lot. There definitely aren't a lot of cassettes, but we do have cassettes as well, and then the VHS F1 tapes. Our project has been broken down into four phases. We're currently in the operations phase, which is a little orange one down there. The first phase, development, that's when everything was transferred to storage. As Charles mentioned earlier, Atau Fine Out Storage in Oakland has been providing free storage for all this stuff, which is relieving us of about $23,000 a year that we have to raise in order just to keep these things in adequate environment. Inauguration phase, that's when, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that during the development phase of, as well as fundraising and getting the stuff into storage, that's when our rough list of holdings was created. It was very, you know, simple. As Stephen was mentioning, you know, labeling on the boxes and stuff aren't necessarily always adequate, and we really rely on digitizing the item first before we can really know what we have. The inauguration phase, we got the preliminary staff on board, and the project was assessed by an archivist who was David Soibert. I don't know if he's still here, but thank you, David. So operations, our focus in this period is the digitization and access, and I'm gonna get into that in the next slide. Completion and delivery, this is obviously an estimate. We planned on the project lasting about 12 years, but we all know that it's very dependent on funding, on, you know, things that happen from year to year. But our estimate delivery time, and which means the completion of the digitization, is hopefully going to be around 2010, 2011, and at that point we can decide what's going to happen to the source materials and find them a good home, and then also find good homes for a lot of the digital files so they can be accessed in other institutions for research purposes. So, yes, funding. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but these are some of the funders who we're really grateful to that have allowed us to do what we're doing. I'll just mention a couple starting from the top. Obviously, the Internet Archive, in the early days, they actually did give us money to get started, but since then, they have been giving us digital online storage for free, unlimited bandwidth, unlimited anything, and we rely heavily on that because the Internet Archive serves as the back end to Radiome, as you saw the screenshot earlier. Save America's Treasures, this was a pretty amazing grant that we were awarded 2 years ago. It was a $180,000 challenge grant, which meant that we had to match dollar for dollar, and we're happy to say that we exceeded the match, and that project period is over, so we no longer have the big bucks. But we are grateful that the Grammy Foundation, I just found out 2 weeks ago, we got awarded for one more year, and that's gonna help us out through the 08-09 period. National Endowment for the Arts, we just also recently got a grant from them, so things are looking good. Okay, methods and workflow. This is kind of a long list, I'm gonna try to say as much as I can, but give you an idea of sort of like what the daily process is these days in the operation phase. Everything starts out with curation. We're really dependent on Charles for this as the artistic director. This helps prioritize the items and helps me create the digitization cues and also the access cues. It sometimes involves Charles going through reports that are like this thick that I generate for him so he can read through everything and make notes on what we should be paying attention to and what we shouldn't. Not that we shouldn't, I don't mean it that way, because I mean, we'd love to digitize everything, but there are some things that can wait. And so we established maybe about a year ago, like this system in our database to help sort stuff as a curatorial level from 1 to 5, 1 being the highest and then 5 being like, well, if we have the money, we can do it, but if we don't get to it, we won't feel guilty. So after the curation is done, the item is, like I mentioned, we have digitization cues, and then I generate reports. the currently prioritized items are checked out, assigned to the engineer, and then they are pulled from storage at ATAU. All the analog to digital transfers are being done at 24-bit 96 kilohertz, and that's because all of the content, usually on reels, will have interviews and music together, so we've set that just to be the standard for everything. So the engineers, they maintain a metadata worksheet log that gets returned back to me, as well as the working hard drives with our master digital files. The items are returned to storage, and all the tape boxes are photographed, front, back, and spine. When the stuff is taken back to the OM office, we have sort of we have the on-site hard drives. All the files are transferred to that. We have a mirror backup that remains off-site. The items are checked in. We reconcile the batch in our database and update all the information with all the technical data and the images. Then all the stuff returns back to Stephen. He completes the cataloging process, and we make notes of any special needs for the future access files, and this includes any need for editing. Like sometimes we'll have, you know, material that will have something that's totally not related to the program, a little bit of news clip or whatnot that needs to be trimmed. And other cases, we will have a program that needs to be reassembled from the master reels. Like we'll have interview on one, and then we'll have various musical selections on others, and those need to be brought back together to make a cohesive program. And once we put it online. We make copies of our master files. We create derivatives at 16.44.1. These are the ones that end up being uploaded to the Internet Archive. Our backup and preservation copies, as I mentioned, we have mirror drives off-site, but we also do create one archival CD, either to CDR or DVD-R, of the master files. And then the access process here. Copies of the access files are put on a separate folder, which are uploaded to the Other Minds collection on the Internet Archive. Once that process is done, our database is updated with all the Internet Archive file information, metadata, and URLs that will later be needed by the Radiome database to display the information correctly. So after our database is updated, I generate an XML export, which will be ingested to the database on the Radiome server, and this will help us see all the new programming and that happens after our little system refresh, which is kind of exciting because recently we didn't have control over that and we were dependent on our web programmer, but now it's in our hands, so we can literally see Radiome updated within like 2 minutes or within the same day after uploading to the Internet Archive. And I'm just going to talk real quick a little bit about some pros and cons of having this partnership. It's a great partnership. We get unlimited bandwidth and storage. The only thing is that right now the storage is for our access copies only. Ideally, it would be for everything, including our preservation files, but because they are a library, they don't want us uploading stuff that the public cannot access, and of course there is material that we can't make public at the moment, so that gets complicated, and so that's kind of out of the picture. The Internet Archive system also generates the derivatives for streaming use, which is really nice because that takes away work from us and having to create and prepping materials for web purposes. Also, another big plus is that I was granted on-site access to the Internet Archive offices, so I can plug directly into their network and upload like maybe 15 programs if you have in one day, versus 2 years ago, we maybe, if we were lucky, got 5 in 1 month because we had to do it from our internet connection in our office. So this has been amazing. And the people at the Internet Archive are really great and good people, fun people to hang around for a day if you have to sit there like I usually do for 8 hours and upload files. So then you might be asking, well, if it's on the Internet Archive and it's available, why do you guys have Radiome? But Radiome is really the face of the Other Minds Archive. There's a lot more content that you can get there that you could get at the Internet Archive. The official launch for the Radiome site, as you saw it before, was in May of this year, but we did have a beta site that was started in 2004, and it went for 3 years. And actually, since our beta site was launched, we've had over 6,000 registrants register to Radiome from over 80 different countries. And we actually use a Google Analytics to find all this information out, so it's been really fun to see who's coming and what they're looking for. So Radiome provides a little bit more detailed information. As you saw, you get more of a mirror image of our database, but just in a different, you know, visual, or should I say aesthetically pleasing format. We also have supplemental material. Eventually, we're going to have a little bit more imagery, anything that's related to the program or to the artists that are contained within the archive. Right now, that's very limited, and that's actually something that we're not going to touch upon in this presentation because it's a whole other project in itself. So, and it also serves as a project tracker. So people that are helping us, whether it be individual donors or funders or the artists and composer themselves, they can go to Radiome and see what's new, what's going on, and find out a little bit more about the program and the history of our archive.
We're about the 5 minutes.
Okay, great, because I'm at the end. This is a screenshot of our, the homepage. So you can see we have a little bit of imagery now. So when you click on the image, it'll generate, it's sort of like doing a search on that particular composer or whatever the caption happens to be. Or actually, I think we're using, aren't we using the subject heading?
Authorized names for these.
Okay. So if you clicked on, well, we just saw a record for Bob Cobbing. If you clicked on Bob Cobbing, it would pull up everything that we have in the archive. If you clicked on Hovannis over there, it would do the same. So last thing. Oh, we're at the 5 minute? Okay, ooh. So these are some concerns and things that we're thinking about now that need to be addressed, but at it's sort of like, long-term goals. Data migration, this has become a really big concern because we've been working with hard drives and we know that necessarily that's not really like the archival standard, but it's the only thing that we can do now. We've had plans to install a server in our office because we found that is going to be way more effective, not just in terms of workflow, but also safeguarding the digital information. The only thing is that technology is changing so much that at the time when we configured the system and got the estimate for how much money we needed to raise to get it, now the system that we wanted is no longer offered, and so now we have to sort of ask, you know, get some more feedback and do some more research and then figure out what it is that we can really do. We also are looking into organizational partnerships for long-term storage and also for dissemination of the preservation copies because, as I said, the Internet Archive right now is only housing our access copies. So we would like to start finding out which institutions out there would be interested in our collection, and that would be a good match, and that could take on the technological responsibility, too, of providing storage in a long-term basis for all the stuff that's been digitized. And so that also brings us to the delivery strategy, which is a few years away, but you know, we like to have an idea and decide at some point soon before the delivery period who would be capable or wanting to take on the original source materials and give it a good home, and same thing with the digital files. And the biggest question, though, is that how do we want to manage requests for submissions to our archive? And we're already getting this, and we think that the KPFA collection has become this big catalyst for I don't know, for people starting to see other minds as something that's a place that they can go to that perhaps could nurture their, you know, music where maybe somebody else wouldn't. And we've had inquiries via the web, via Radiome, from composers, you know, if we'd be interested in taking their stuff, and we're not quite sure how to handle that because we already have our plate pretty full with the KPFA material. But this is something that we definitely need to figure out, and I'm sure it's something that we want to do. I mean, it's there, it's become a part of our daily operations now. It's not just the music festival and such, but preservation has become really important to us, and we want to do what we can and keep it going. So, is that it? Time for questions, or do we have a minute and a half to hear some? Okay, the medley. If you're really curious to what it is, I don't want to list it because the clips are so short that if I try to talk over it, I won't be able to give you adequate information. So if you'd like to know, ask me. But for now, I just titled it Piano Gut Fit Belkoff with Guitar T Symphony for Tech Sound and Computer Lab. So I will play this, and then maybe you guys can play Name That Tune or something. No? There we go.
says it's fine.
Thanks.